and exam writing tips and dealing with stress and those kinds of things. So hopefully that will be useful. Next slide. This is what's posted there in terms of what room to go to on Thursday at 2 o'clock. I'm going to be there at like 1:30 with all the TAs and the faculty and invigilators and all that, helping them set up. And then we're going to open the doors at 1:50 to let everybody in. And then at 2 o'clock, we will say, 2:00, we'll say, you may begin writing. And then it's a two-hour long test. So it's a bit different than how we do the midterms when they start 10 minutes after. So try to be there a bit early. This recording's going okay? So we're going to post this recording. I'll post the slides. And if I write anything on the slides, I'll post those as well. Okay. So, and I don't know if you can maybe take the lights off the front there. Can you figure out? It's just a little. I'm afraid of those light switches, but. You're obviously allowed a calculator. You'll need one of those, and maybe some backup batteries or something, or even that's exactly what I don't want. Those on, and then somehow the front off. I've spent.
You can buy it.
Don't forget to write up an aid sheet. I would say it's good to have your aid sheets as something that you're very familiar with and that you've been doing your mastering physics with over, you know, weeks and weeks. Perfect. That's definitely. So that you know where everything is, where all the equations are, and you can write anything you want there. You can put down little examples of how to do your thin film or anything that you feel could be useful on an exam. A ruler probably won't be useful in this exam, but you can bring it if you want. You're allowed like a translation dictionary, but it has to be made of paper. Also, you know, something to write with, your T card, a watch, exam against you, Theo Sharp. So some little hints. It's good to skim over the test. Before you begin, look for problems you have confidence to solve first. That's sort of the trick with all these things, right, is that you want to feel confident that you're putting down correct answers and that you're not just kind of sort of guessing, or you don't really know, or you didn't take time to work through things. So if you don't have time when you're on your first pass, just skip it and come back to it later. Do the easy ones. So bring something. I always bring a banana every exam, and then halfway through that, when I'm really feeling stressed out, I open up the banana just for some reason. Just takes away some of that stress. Some of these things, I guess, there's an Apple Watch, you know. I would say just stay right to 2 or 4 o'clock. Sort of plan to, you know, even if you spend the last half an hour only getting another 5%, it's worth so much to your course mark that would be good. Are there any questions or thoughts about anything specifically before we launch into materials? So, yes.
What's the average of term test two?
Average of term test two. You can click on statistics there. I think it was 65%. Pretty much exactly, and that includes the another long answer. I think with one of the long answers, one of them went really well, one of them went really poorly, and they kind of averaged out 6 times. Yes?
When will we get back?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there are listed on a portal all of these sessions that are happening in the practicals with your TAs. So basically, what April did, she doesn't want them, she gave them all the envelopes to your TA. So you have like a TA1. That is who has your test right now in an envelope, along with all the people in your particular group. And so you have to either find them in that session or go to that TA's office hours or email the TA or something. It's too much for April to distribute them all back to all 650 of you. So find your TA1, and that's where your test is. That's a great question. Okay. Yeah. So here is a last year's final exam. There was this crazy question. Does anyone know what this is about? Just Doppler, right? So let's go a little bit of review of Doppler, and then we'll try it. So the basic idea was this. There's two ways of deriving this equation based on two what I think are fairly different physical ideas. One is that the source is sitting stationary, the wavelength is whatever it is, and what happens is the observer is moving either toward or away from that source, and because you're moving, you hit these wave fronts at a different frequency than you would if you were standing still. It changes the frequency directly. And then the other thing that can happen is you might be standing still, and then the source is moving, and then what happens is that the wavelength is shortened in front and stretched behind. And since the frequency is speed divided by wavelength, this affects the frequency as well. And so you end up with these equations that are either 1 over 1 minus V over V. That's when the wavelength is directly affected. That's when you have the source is moving. And if the observer is moving, then it's on the numerator. So these equations are slightly different. And it's all relative to the air. So if there's a wind blowing, you have to kind of go to the air frame of reference traveling along with the wind. So that's what I'm going to do for this crazy exam question. So, I said that for these equations, basically all Doppler velocities are relative to the air. So you need to switch to a reference frame in which the air is stationary. So for Lu, so this is all relative to the air. Lu, you've got he's in the air frame of reference. I would say that actually Lu is moving to the right at V equals 20 meters per second. And then the source is actually stationary. Vs is zero, and this is V observer, isn't it? And then for Sue, it's actually the same thing. The observer is 20 meters per second. So what do you think the answer is? Yeah, I think it's V. And we'll do some clicker questions later. So hopefully you did bring a clicker or an iClicker Go, and we'll try some. But I think this one, we'll just say here, is that relative to the air, this is the same situation, exactly. It's an observer moving toward a source at 20 meters per second. Same situation relative to air. Same frequency shift. And if you were asked what the frequency was, then you would use this one with the observer moving. And the source stationary relative to the air. In both those cases. Okay. Yes? Question?
Is there a difference if it's constant speed and decreasing speed? Like if you're approaching a person at constant speed?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the Doppler effect, the frequency is just related to the instantaneous velocity, right? So if there's an acceleration, then the frequency is also going to have a rate of change. Rate of change in the frequency would be proportional to the rate of change of the velocity. It's pretty rare though. So basically, there's a frequency at any instant. That's going to be what the velocity is at that instant. And that was another thing we went over in class quite a bit. Is that with these, as the objects get closer and closer, or further and further away from each other, the frequency doesn't change as long as the velocities are constant. Right, the frequency remains either higher than its rest frequency or lower than its rest frequency. But it doesn't go up and up and up. It's not changing. Yes?
But the speaker is also moving, so wouldn't the source be moving as well?
No, because it's stationary relative to the air. There's a wind moving to the left, and at the same rate, so I switched to the reference frame of the air in that case. Okay, so I'm going to... sort of a busy sort of day, so I'm switching to all sorts of different ideas here. This was something to do with this thin film. It's saying oil leaks out of the engine of a boat, forms a thin film. You can read it from the back. You look straight down and see a bright reflection of sunlight, and it tells you the index or a fraction of oil So it said both the water and the oil have indices of refraction greater than that of air. And it also says that N water is less than N oil. So I'm going to go back and review this thing a little bit. I've got all these clip art people looking a little confused. And this is something, a little bit of a theme here, is that when you get to the exam on Thursday, you will see questions you don't know the answer to. That's, you know, perfectly normal. What you do is that you have to work through these questions. Right? It's not like you know, a memorization thing where you sort of know it or you don't. You have your aid sheet, you have your brain, you have ideas that you might get in the middle of the exam that will help you solve these things. So just to review, it's basically you're combining these reflections from the front surface combined with the reflection from the back surface. Okay, because there is in each surface, there's both the wave is split into both a transmitted and a reflected wave. And so it's the reflected from the first, then some of it gets transmitted, and then you get some reflected from the second. And if this is constructive, you get a bright reflection. If this is destructive, you get a dark reflection. And so there's anti-reflection coatings. This one is specifically saying you want bright. And then there was these slides, which had this whole business with the pi phase shift. The whole idea there is that you get a flip of amplitude if you are reflecting off a surface where the wave would go slower. And when you take a sine wave and you flip it upside down, that is the same as adding a phase shift of half a wavelength, okay, or a phase shift of pi. So, meaning that if n, the original n is less than the second n, then that gives you pi phase shift. If it's in the case where the substrate is a greater index than the film, and then the film is a greater index than the air, then you get pi's on both, they cancel out, and these are the equations that Knight derives. This is the case where the substrate index is greater than the film. But I think we've got the opposite, which just flips everything. Okay? And what's happening here is you have a flip on the first surface, air to film, but then you don't have a flip on the second surface, the film to whatever's below it, the water, I guess. And then it flips these equations around, so the constructive becomes destructive, and destructive becomes constructive. So just this minus a half switching around. It's good to have both these equations in the configuration, both these sets. Okay?
So let's do it.
Back here, we want bright. So this means we want constructive. So it's just finding which equation. So, and I can draw it again. I've got air, I've got oil, water. The waves are coming in, reflecting off this and reflecting off this. N oil is greater than N air. So that means that there's a pi shift. And then N water is less than N oil. So that means that there's zero shift. And so that means we use the one where it's lambda is equal to 2. And now, actually, do you remember which N you use here? 2ND. Pardon?
Oil.
Right, exactly. This is the oil wavelength. So what's going on is you're just counting waves that are happening inside the film, because that's where the second ray, that's the difference between the first reflection and the second reflection. The second reflection has traveled twice through the film, or through that oil. And so the relevant index of refraction is the one that's in the oil for this equation. And then, so that's lambda C, I guess, constructive. And M here equals 1, 2, and 3. So the minimum value of M is 1. You can't have negative wavelengths, obviously. Can't be 0. And then we just solve for D. We get D is equal to lambda. I'm just going to leave that M in there, minus a half over 2N oil. And now we can see that the minimum thickness, actually I use T, is going to be for M equals 1.
minimum when n equals 1. And so d is going to be equal to, it's going to be a half in the bottom, so lambda times a half over 2n oil. And now you're starting to see it's lambda or 4n oil. So the answer is C. Okay, questions about this? Yes. Always in the air. So these equations are all the, what are called the vacuum wavelengths, I guess. It's a really good point. So even if you're talking about what goes on down below, I guess it's like actually a way of specifying the frequency, because that's what matters to determine the color of the light. Good question. Okay. Next on our list here, oh yeah, this one. So actually, this is a clicker question. Did anybody bring clicker? Remember this one? The question was, you're looking straight down into the water at a fish. And the question was, an observer sees the fish at a depth greater than it really is, B, its true depth, or C, a depth smaller than it really is. Find it here while you guys think about that. Good time to discuss.
Ray optics.
Okay, 34. Anybody else remember this one? Survey says. Smaller depth, so that was good. Right, I think I had a little animation. The idea is that the rays come out, they're diverging a certain amount, and your eye somehow can kind of tell, even one eye can judge depth by how much the rays appear to be diverging, even from a single point. It'll be blurry or not, depending on how far away it is. So that's the idea, is that when you go from a higher index to a lower index, your ray bends away from the normal. So it's going to do that. See what I'm saying? So your little Snell's law, you'll go away from the normal there, you go away from the normal there, and it'll appear to be diverging from a point that's at a smaller depth. And the equation that's in Knight here, this is equation 23.13, is S prime is equal to N2 over N1 times S. So
wait, that would make S prime bigger.
Oh, no. Sorry. I was thinking actually that N1 is on the top, N2 is on the bottom, but don't forget, the light goes from the fish to you, right? So you start, N1 is down here, and N2 is up here. I always get that mixed up because I'm looking at a fish, so I think of the fish as being an N2, but that's not right. The light, it starts somewhere, reflects off the fish, and that's when it starts its journey toward your eye. It goes from N1 to N2. So S prime is less than a S. And we didn't do lenses because I got sick that one day. I seem to remember. Unfortunately, didn't happen. But we did this kind of stuff. Snell's law and that kind of thing. Any questions on this ray optics stuff? Yep. Yeah, usually that's right. Yeah. Well, especially for this particular equation, N1 is where the light started. N1 is where the object is. Okay. All right. So then, a lot of this course was electricity and magnetism. The whole middle part, I guess, probably 75% of the course.
So I'll just go through some basic stuff. One basic idea, I've had some questions about this over the email, is that the force on an object, and we sometimes call this object the probe charge, is Q, that's the charge on that probe particle, times E, the electric field. And the electric field is coming from a whole bunch of source charges. So it is a little confusing, is that sometimes there's you can get mixed up between what's the source and what's the probe. But here, you might have multiple charges, or just might have a big parallel plate capacitor or something. Something's giving you an electric field, and then you put an object in there, there's a force on that object. And, you know, if it's a negative, like if it's an electron, the force is opposite the direction of the electric field. So, and that's where you get units of electric field, it's newtons per coulomb. So this one, again, some of these are quizzes that got really bombed during the semester. So, do you remember this one? Okay. Acceleration. Which proton has the larger acceleration? So it says both have the same ahead. Very good. Same acceleration. Oh, there are still people guessing that. Let's stop it. Right. So they both have the same. So this is actually acceleration is related to force. There's no gravity usually in these things. They're just neglect gravity, because it's a much weaker force than the electric force. The force is coming from the electric field. It's Q times electric field. So what we're really saying here is that the electric field does not depend on the distance from an infinite plane of charge.
Which is a bit of a surprising result. Okay, it's just these little arrows all have the same length, no matter how far you are away. You could be infinitely far away from the infinite charge plane, and it still would be the same as if you're, you know, 1 millimeter away from it. A bit strange. But anyway, there's the equation. It doesn't depend on z, except it flips when you get to the other side of the plane. Right? It's always pointing away from a positive plane or always towards a negative plane. And so, this is covered up here, but capacitors, a parallel plate capacitor, is two of these planes. And if the distance between the planes is quite a lot smaller than, say, the diameter of these disks or something, then we can approximate inside the parallel plate capacitor, it's approximately two infinite sheets. Okay? So you've got one covered with sort of smoothly distributed positive charge, one's covered with negative charge. So if you think about the electric fields, they're going to be away from the plus, right? And they're going to be towards the negative. So inside, there's actually double the amount of electric field as you would think from either plate, because they're both pointing, in this case, to the right. And then outside the parallel plate capacitor, they do cancel. Capacitors are used to store charge. That's what capacitor means. It's capacity to store charge given a voltage. So you hook a battery, DC battery, across your capacitor, and then it stores some charge there. A defibrillator works or something, is that you charge up a capacitor, and capacitors have the property that they can discharge pretty quickly compared to a battery. You get a lot of power in a short amount of time, and then you start your heart. Okay. Motion of a charged particle in an electric something field. Consider a particle charged Q, mass M. Go back to this. Basically, there it is. It's going to move with some constant acceleration. So this actually is why we put some random kinematics equations on the front page of the test. I think you may have seen that on the test two be the same set of equations on the final exam as well in the possibly helpful information. Because here is an example in which you need to use the kinematics equations. Inkjet printer. Touch the screen here, sorry. Let's go through this. Read it. It says, okay, it's a parallel plate capacitor. We're going to assume that D is much, much smaller than L, I guess. So we're going to assume uniform electric field that's inside there. And we're going to call that's just E. So you know that. And it must be an electron or negative charge. But it's asking, what is the maximum charge, I guess maximum magnitude of charge on this droplet so that it does not hit a plate? It's going to curve upwards. And what we will say, I think, is that the max charge will be when it just hits the corner of that plate, right? Kind of just hits right there, I guess, right? Hits corner of the plate. So, let's draw a little sketch of what that's going to look like. It's going to go whoop like that. It's going to, we can set up the x and y axis if we want. The acceleration is just upwards because that's the direction, that's opposite the direction of the electric field. It's a negative charge. So the distance it goes in the x direction, delta x, is equal to L. And the distance it goes in the y direction, delta y, is equal to d over 2, I guess, right? Because it starts in the middle of the plate and ends up at the edge, d over 2. And then A sub y is equal to F net divided by the mass. That's your Newton's second law for that particle. We're neglecting gravity. So, and also you've got Vy initial equals zero. So delta y is equal to 1/2 A sub y t squared. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the y motion and get it in terms of time. And then we're going to do the x motion, get it in terms of time, and then time is the same for x and y. And so eliminate time, and then we're going to solve. We're supposed to solve for charge, I guess. So it's d over 2 is the y, delta y is equal to, and what's the, we can put it, it's going to be the force divided by 2m. Times t squared. And don't forget that F is equal to E times Q. So you got D over 2 is equal to E Q over 2m times t squared. Maybe call that equation 1. Okay, so that's the y motion. For the x motion, it's constant speed in x because the acceleration is in y. So it's just delta x is equal to v sub x times t. So that L is equal to v times t. So you can solve that for t actually. T is L over v. And then we can take this t and just plug it into here. And actually that'll, I think now we can just solve for q. So I've got d over 2 is equal to E Q over 2M L over V squared, solve for Q. I got Q is equal to D times V squared times M divided by L squared E. Now this is the point where you kind of panic because it's not in the list. It's not in the list. You see it though? Again, this is the time that I open the banana. Anybody see it? Very good. It's actually B. So it's just rearranged a little bit, right? And that may sometimes happen that you'll have to try to match it to one of the five answers, right? And you'll have to rearrange things a little bit. Sometimes these answers come out symbolically. Then again, it's keeping you cool. looking at each. And that's actually a multiple choice test rating strategy. Is you should always look at the five answers that are given and cross off ones that aren't making sense and see if you can kind of take any shortcuts. Any questions about that? Okay. So we said the units of electric field are newtons per coulomb, because the force is the electric field times the charge. Another unit is going to be this volts per meter. So, and this is this idea of electric potential, which is the electric potential energy per charge for any part of space. It's really useful when you're hooking up a circuit, because a battery or a plug or something creates an electric potential difference. That's the same thing as a voltage. Sometimes you put a delta V, sometimes people just put V as being the potential difference. Okay. And then for a uniform electric field, it's just the difference in electric potential divided by the distance is the electric field strength. And the rule is that the electric field points from high potential towards lower potential. And the way I try to remember that is that potential is kind of like altitude on one of these maps. Like, you talk about equipotentials, there's also, what do you call the lines on a contour map? Anyway, they mark equal height, right? And so if you have a little marble or something, it rolls to the lower height naturally. So if you have a positive charge and it's in looking at equipotentials, it tends to roll from the higher potentials towards the lower potentials. It's getting pushed by that electric force. So there's an analogy there. Okay. So if we know a capacitor is delta V, and we know the distance between the plates, the electric field is delta V over D. That implies electric field units are actually volts per meter, same as newtons per coulomb. Those are the same. So let's just look at, now this is a case where I got this off the past exams website and just could barely read it. So I don't know what the photocopy looked like in the actual exam room. And if you got a photocopy like this, this would be a good situation, where you might want to raise your hand and say, what? I can't even read this. Okay, so, but I think what it is there's a B there, and there's an arrow pointing to the right, and there's an arrow pointing to the left. I don't think your photocopy is going to be this bad on Thursday, but the image shows two regions with the electric field as labeled. So the direction is given there, and then the magnitude is given below. Which point, A, B, or C, has the highest electric potential? Now remember, you can set any zero point, and also remember, the zero point doesn't matter, because it's arbitrary, but the electric field direction points from high to low potential points. Let's say in direction of decreasing V. So I can tell you right now that B must have the lowest potential. Okay, so it's not B. So it's either A or C, and then we have to work that out based on those electric fields. See what I'm saying? But it's like you're rolling towards that center. That's going to be the bottom of the potential. And then the slope is the electric field. So E, I guess the magnitude of E is going to be delta V divided by delta X. Okay? So let's actually assume for now that we'll just say V sub B is equal to zero. That's our arbitrary zero point. Arbitrary zero point. And then, so VA is going to be E times delta X. It's going to be the 100 volts per meter times the 0.3, so I got 30 volts. That's the potential of A, and then VB is going to be, again, E delta X is 33 times 1, so 33 volts. So the highest electric potential, B, this is supposed to be C, right? It's C. Any questions about that one? That's good. What's the next one? Yeah, the next one's a clicker question. That one. And like I say, I'll post these. So I already posted some, like, the four slides on my lectures Harlow page. That's the same place where I'll post the, yeah. What is the total potential difference from A to B? And you got three batteries hooked up this way. So they tell you to hook up batteries always plus minus, but what if you hooked them up backwards? Okay. Should we look at the survey? Survey says. Five. I think that was where what I got as well. So basic idea is just that you can define arbitrary 0 point, your B equals 0 here, in which case you're gonna go minus plus. Okay? So that means you're going up in potential across the battery. So that's what the DC battery does, is it creates a potential difference between the minus and the plus sides. And the plus is always that many volts higher than the minus side. So you're going to go up 3, and then you flip this around, you're going to go down 1, back to 2, and then you're going to go up 3 again, up to 5. So the electric potential, V, is a property of space. Any particular point in space has a scalar number associated with it, which is the electric potential. Now, and then you can also change it by just changing where the 0 point is, but you would change the whole universe that by that amount. So, okay. It changes by its EMF, so Knight calls it that little curly E as being the EMF of the battery. B is higher on the plus side of the battery. So that's the definition of electric potential. The definition of current is that it's the rate of change, or rate at which charge flows. So dQ by dt. So basically, if you've got some isolated system and there's some current flowing out of it, if this system has charge Q, as the current flows away, that's how much the charge will be decreasing over time. But in practice, what it is that you've got a wire going along. You look at a cross-section of the wire. Every second, there'll be some amount of charge in coulombs that passes through some particular cross-section of that wire. Okay, so it's like there's a window, and you're counting how many electrons flew through the window every second. How much charge per second went through the window. Amps. 1 amp is coulomb per second. And so, once you've got electric potential, and you've got current, you got these concepts figured out, then you get Ohm's law. Idea with Ohm's law is that you've got a wire. What is a wire? Well, it's a big long cylinder that has some cross-sectional area A and some length L. And it's made out of a material that has a resistivity rho. Whatever that means. It's just that the metal has some ability to slow down any moving electrons that are going through it. As charge moves through it, it feels resistance to motion. And in fact, it's just like, it's a lot like air resistance in that it increases quite a lot with velocity. So what happens is that this force, electric field, creates an acceleration. These charges only accelerate for like a nanosecond, and then they reach terminal velocity and just truck along at a constant speed. And that's why your Ohm's law
have any rate of change of current. It's just a steady current is produced by this force. And that's because everything's moving along a terminal velocity. It's already reached as fast as it can go. So there was a situation when you set up this delta V in which probably all those electrons were accelerating for a little bit, but that only happened for a nanosecond. Now they're going at some steady rate around the or through the wire. And that rate is going to be higher if you crank up the delta V, and it's going to be lower if you crank up the resistance. And you can change the resistance by either making, however it goes there, resistance is going to be a longer wire will have longer resistance, a narrower cross-sectional area, or a higher resistivity material.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And then so then there's all this skills of drawing circuit diagrams. And this is a big skill for the test. And sometimes you have to redraw things to kind of make it look different. This is, I guess, I don't know what's going on here. You got a battery, and I think the capacitor and the resistor are in parallel to one another. That's what I'm seeing. So what you have to do is kind of redraw this. And I like to draw the battery kind of over on the left or something, on the one side of it. And then if I have things that are in parallel, meaning that there's a junction and the current has a choice to go through one or the other, then I like to, on my diagram, I like to draw them parallel to each other, just so that I can kind of remember to use the right equations or whatever. So this, you've got a resistor in parallel to a capacitor. And then they join up against another junction and are connected back to that.
To that battery. So what do we got here?
Well, maybe we should do an example of that. So these are these equations, is just that if resistors are in series, then you add up the resistances to get an equivalent resistance. And if they're in parallel, then you take the 1 over all the resistances, add those up, and then take 1 over that to get the equivalent resistance. You add the reciprocals and take the reciprocal of the sum. Okay? So, here is a question. It says, what's the equivalent resistance from A to B? And it's got a little wire that hops over the other wire, and it just looks awful, okay? And actually, I'll admit to you that I stared at this one for a while. This is what we call a challenge exam problem, but it could happen. Okay, so what you have to do is take a deep breath and go, okay, what I need to do here is redraw this diagram, okay? And I may even have to redraw it a few times before I actually get something that I like. So I think the first thing I'm going to do is take that stupid triangle that goes to B and just fold it out. Because I don't like wires hopping over other wires. It's just too confusing. So can you imagine doing that? So I could start with A. Here's your A. And here's your, I don't like drawing squiggly things either. So there's your R1. And there's, what does it do? It goes. So there's another thing here that goes down. I'm going to keep that wire, R4. So what I'm doing is I'm redrawing this. And then it comes down, and then there's this crazy R3 in between them. Now I'm folding that thing over, whoop, over to the other side, so that B is now here. Doesn't that look nicer? And then you've got R2 like that. It still looks pretty horrendous. But at least no wires are hopping over other wires. Okay, and so now is the really tricky part, is I need to draw it the way I like to do it, is get parallel things parallel. And so the trick here to realize is that what a wire is an equipotential. It connects everything to the same potential. So you can see that the R4 is connected directly to A on one side, and it's connected directly to B on the other side. So that's one option for the current to have, is it can go through R4 and that's it. So I'm going to draw that again. Let's redraw again. Redraw. Since the current has an option to go from A to B just through R4, that means that everything else is parallel to R4. Okay? That's one way. And then there's going to be a junction here, and it'll go junction back up there. So the other way it can go, if it doesn't go through R4, I'm pretty sure it has to go through R1. Right? So I can now say that R1 is up here, kind of parallel. And then there's another junction, I think. In order to get from R1 to B, it can either go through R2 or go through R3, and then it'll get back to B. Just follow what I'm doing here. And then they connect back up again. This is the same circuit, but redrawn now, and now I can do it. Because now I know R2 and R3, they're parallel to each other. There's an equivalent resistance there by adding the reciprocal and the whatever. And then I know that R1 is in series with this thingy, so I just add those. And I know that all this is in parallel with this. We're going to be done in a minute. Yes?
What if we had like the same wire, where we had two different wires in the middle? What if we had the same wire? How would you do
If they're touching there instead of jumping, you mean?
Not touching, like if there was the same wire. Like, if there were two different wires, so if you couldn't like flip it, like you
would. I can't picture what you're trying to say. So I.
So now we have like kind of like one wire, and then we have another wire on the top. But what if we had like them two together? Like this is one wire.
Yeah, instead of a jump, it's a connection or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would just be a different circuit. I'd have to redraw it some other way. Like, it takes a lot of practice doing all these things and trying to redraw it, but at some point, you want to redraw it so that you can just use those same old series and parallel rules. I'm not answering your question because I just don't. Sorry. I'm going to continue with this one. So basically, the first thing I do is a parallel rule, which is that R equivalent of 2, 3 is equal to 1 over, what is it? Well, they're all 4 ohms. So 1 over 4 plus 1 over 4 to the minus 1. So this equals 1 over 2, I think, to the minus 1, which equals 2 ohms. So that little pair right there is equivalent to a 2 ohm resistor. And it's in series of the 4 ohms, so it's going to be 6. So then there's a series. See what I'm doing now? You've got R equivalent of 1, 2, and 3. It's going to be 4 plus 2. 6 ohms. And then that's all in parallel with R4. R equivalent of 1, 2, 3, 4 is going to be 1 over 6. Plus 1 over 4 to the minus 1. You can do that in your calculator, or you can do some fancy common denominators if you want, I guess. I don't know. What is it? 4 over 24 plus 6 over 24 or something? I don't know. Let's say I forgot my calculator, and I've got 10 over 24 to the minus 1. Equals 24 over 10. 2.4 ohms. Any questions about that one? That was a hard one. The hardest step is redrawing the circuit till it gives you something that where all the resistors are clearly in parallel with each other, or every section is parallel or a series. And perfect timing. Hello? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
These are all really good advice. I remember I had a lot of anxiety problems when I was writing tests and exams, and I had so many tricks just to calm myself down. One of them was to stop studying at some point. Like, say, for example, noon on Thursday, I would just say to myself, that's it. I close my book like this, and I go, whatever's in my head now, that's what's going to be in my head in the exam, and this is who I am. Like that, these 2 hours, you know, they're not going to make any difference anyway. It's only 2 hours, right? I can't possibly cram anything more in there. I could probably, but I'm not going to.
Totally.
This is who I am. And so I go get a coffee and just go and wait around, and someone say, oh, I'm trying to study this. I don't care about that. I'm done studying. And that helped me a bit.
Thank you so much. Good luck, everyone.
So this is where we left off. So there was this electric potential difference in voltage. I mean, the same thing. These are some sort of morals of the story. It's good to use the word voltage across, like
a resistor or a cross, even a battery or something, and current through each element. And then also this idea that once you've got a wire, if it connects any two places, what you're doing there is you're setting up an equipotential. That's what a wire does. It's a conductor. A conducting surface is an equipotential surface. Electrostatics and the same wires. As long as it's a perfect conductor, I guess. So I was thinking what we could try, although this might end up in disaster, but I think I've got the time, is that maybe we could try Anastasia's question, and I think what you were trying to say is connect them. Which is gone. But let's just say maybe that's what she was asking. What happens if you connect those? Then what would you do? Well, okay, so now I'm thinking, your current has to kind of, so you're going to redraw. And again, I can kind of see it's going to split there. And it has to, so one way it can go is it can still go through resistor 2, I think, all the way to B, or resistor 4 all the way to B. So I would say, here's your A. And there is kind of this option of just going resistor 2 and then connect to B, or resistor 4. I think those now are in parallel to one another. But then there's another option, which is you could go through R1 and then R3, which are kind of in series. I don't know if this is the last one, and then kind of connect ourselves back there. But then there's the other thing, which is you could go R1 and then through R2. So that's not working too well. Or you could go through R1 and then through R4. So it's like it's somehow connected back here again. I don't know how that's going to help us. But now I kind of think, so redraw R1. See, this is why I shouldn't have done this. Because it's hard to think when you're in front of a whole huge crowd. What's R1 parallel to, though?
R3 is parallel to R4, and R4 is parallel to R2, but R1 isn't parallel to anything.
See, I don't think everything's parallel, because it's like R1 is not, it's like parallel to nothing, and then all these things become
parallel.
So what I think is happening here is that you've got R3, R4 and R2 are all parallel to one another. And then what's happening is R1 can just be circumvented. Okay? And so what actually will happen here is that R1 is now, it's short-circuited. So it means it's no longer really part of this circuit. No current will go through there. Because the current has a choice to either go through a wire or go through a resistor. A wire has zero resistance, so you have zero current through R1. So that's what happens here, I think. Zero current in R1. So it's got no voltage drop. So basically all it is R equivalent is just going to be 1 over 4 plus 1 over 4 plus 1 over 4 minus 1. So it's equal to 4/3. So that can happen, is that you can kind of short circuit yourself around a resistor and take it out of the circuit this way. Okay. Any questions about that? All right. So this is this demo. What this is, I don't know if did you guys see this with Andrew? Did? Oh, well, okay, so it's a 60-watt light bulb and a 100-watt light bulb. I'll go through it again in case you don't remember. I should have gone to it.
I think we saw it with you. Did it see you?
I think so. I didn't do it. the question is, If the bulbs are wired in parallel, so I've got a series switch versus a parallel switch, that's going to be, if I click on parallel, which one will be brighter? The 100-watt bulb or the 60-watt bulb? Did you ever say this? Whoa! It's sort of half and half, okay? So what we have to do is actually turn it on and see. This is the 100-watt, this is the 60-watt. So the one at the 100-watt is a little bit brighter. It's pretty hard to tell, honestly. If I kind of blur my eyes, they look about the same. I don't know. Anyway, the answer is that it is, it's B. It's the 100. And the idea there is that the power that's consumed is proportional to the brightness. Okay. It's creating heat, but it's also creating light. And so if they're equally efficient, then the one that's creating, you know, using more power certainly will be producing more light as well. And the labels, 100 watt and 60 watt, are put on there assuming that they're put over 120 volts of voltage. Yes, question?
So if the equation for power is V squared over R,
yeah.
What if the greater the resistance means the less the power?
Yeah, exactly. So what that actually means is that the resistance of the 60-watt bulb must actually be greater than the resistance of the 100-watt bulb. So what's going on here is that the current comes here, it splits, and it can go through this resistor or it can go through this resistor. More current is going to go through the lower resistance one, right? It'll go in the widest creek, right? And remember, the power is current times voltage. They both have the same volts across, 120, so the one with the more current through it will be the brighter one. And the one with the more current through it is this one, so it's got lower resistance. That's going to make it brighter, because you reduce the resistance. Yes, question?
I think Mark told me that this
is going to be on my test, that's for sure. It's not tricky at all. It's tricky for sure, but it's certainly on the... Maybe not on test two, but it is on the final exam, that's for sure. well, we could ask him, I guess. Anyway, I don't think this is beyond you guys. You guys are very smart. Okay, so now, what if they're in series? Can I have a switch for that? Which will we write? Says? Most people are saying the 60-watt bulb will be brighter in series, and it certainly is. There's the 60, there's the 100. So, and now that is no longer the actual volts, because these things are no longer, there's no longer 120 volts across both of them. I think, well, I don't know which would be actually, but so the answer is definitely... 60. So what's the same about series now? It's the same current running through both of them, and the volts are different. So you could use P equals I squared R now. It's another way of looking at that. Larger resistance, larger the power. Okay. So you're pushing some amount of current through both of these things now. The one with larger resistance will have a larger voltage drop, and so it's going to have more power. Yes? Always power, yeah. Yeah, because in this case, they both have the same current. Okay, but the difference is the voltage drops much more through the 60-watt bulb than it does through the 100-watt bulb. And so it's got more heat being generated in there. Okay? And more light as well. It's weird to say that the power of 60-watt is greater than the power of 100-watt. But remember, these labels are just actually referring to the resistance. Resistance is what's actually true. Right? And doesn't change depending on how much volts you put across it.
This is assumed if there's 120 volts, that it would be 50 watts. Now it's definitely,
that's definitely not 100 watts there. I can even touch it. Okay, and then the other thing I'm going to do, and I need my gloves for this one, is, what have I done? No. How do I unzoom? Oh, dear. I hit the wrong thing in PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm good. I pressed escape. Okay, yeah, so the moral of the story is the thing that is the same for resistors in parallel is voltage. So you could use V squared over R to compare power. Higher power corresponds to lower resistance. The thing that's the same for resistors in series is current. So you use your I squared R. Higher resistance corresponds to higher power. Okay. And then in your house, parallel is always used. And there's even another reason. And so this is the next demonstration. Is that what if I unscrew the 100 watt light bulb? And it's going to do it. Ow. It's a little hot. It's not too bad. I'm going to take it out of the circuit. And maybe I would have hit it with a hammer or something like that. Somehow it breaks. So now that is broken. And the question is, in series, will the 60 watt bulb turn on or not? Yes, no. A is yes, B is no. Survey says, most people say no, turn on, nothing. Okay? Because if I've now broken this circuit, it can't get to ground. And then the other one is, it will not light up. What about parallel? Oops. I'm doing the same quiz here, but this one isn't even counted, right? So what if I now put it in parallel? Will the 60 watt light up even though I've broken the 100 watt? A, yes, it'll light up. B, it won't. Okay. Parallel, boom. Okay, and so that's another reason why your house is wired in parallel, because every time you turned off a switch, all the other ones would go, the whole thing would go off if you had everything in series, right? Every time one light bulb burnt out, then boom, your whole Christmas tree goes off.
Wasn't it brighter than this initial when the other bulb was also on?
Oh, with parallel? Should we try that? So if I screw this back in, you want to know if this one dims? Seem to change. Not much, anyway. Okay, because it's still 120 volts across it. Doesn't matter. Okay, unless maybe there's some actual resistance in Toronto Hydro or something like that, like the internal resistance of a battery or something like that, which can sometimes happen. But generally, no, it completely does not matter. Unless it's in series. Whoop, oh, it's off completely. There you go. So, you know, so yeah, it doesn't make a difference. Okay, good. What's next on the list here? It lights up. Yeah, so this is, now we're into magnetic forces and right-hand rules and all this business. And that's a fun thing to do. And when you're invigilating a test like this, is to look around at all the students going like, you know, whoa, their right hand, trying to write with their left hand and stuff like that. It's always amusing. It's very boring to invigilate exams, just to... They ever become a TA, that's one of the reasons we pay them so well. Okay. Particle charge Q travels through two chambers as shown. So this is one of those ones with a confused person where I'm going to review, right? There he is. Okay. So let's just review a little bit. We'll come back to this question. The right-hand rule for fields. So there's a couple of different right-hand rules in night. One is that you've got a current-carrying wire or a charge that's moving along. Which way is the magnetic field that is created by that moving charge? And then you can use your thumb, is the velocity of that source charge, the current. And then you curl the fingers in your right hand to indicate the direction of the magnetic field. And you remember that the magnetic field is always going to be concentric circles around that wire. And so is it counterclockwise or clockwise? And you do that with just turning. So as viewed from above, this is a counterclockwise magnetic field around a current which is coming out of the page. And there it is kind of again. This is where you've got your current now going in a loop, but you can still use that right-hand rule, maybe stay on the bottom,
current's going to the right, so thumb to the right. So if my fingers are above, then they're going to bend up out of the page, so the dots mean. And if my fingers are below, then they're going to point into the page, what all the X's mean. You can do that all the way around. And it's hard to visualize all this stuff in 3D, but there it is. And then, what's the next one? And here's a solenoid. This is where you've got an N on top for a whole bunch of loops. Number of loops is N. Current, there's your permeability of free space. And this is divided by, I think, the length of that solenoid. It gives you the magnetic field side in the solid. And so the N, little N is number of loops per length. What was all this about? Yeah, so we're going to right-hand rule for forces. There's lots of them, but one that I've sometimes used is you have make your fingers like this, so your middle finger is the force, or sometimes your palm, I guess, is the force, and then your thumb finger, again, is the velocity. Now, this in this case, it's actually the velocity of the probe charge, so now this charge is moving through a magnetic field that was set up by some sources, right? So the magnetic field is now your index finger, your pointy finger. And now you've got three mutually perpendicular vectors. Or at least, it's a cross product. So I think V and B don't have to necessarily be perpendicular, but certainly the force is perpendicular to both of them. Well, so just charge is charge, but what I like to think of the difference between probe charge and source charge. Uh-huh. So if we go back, all this business was this current is kind of like the source of the magnetic field. It's what's creating this magnetic field over here. Whereas in this case, it's getting some charge is getting pushed by an external magnetic field. So that's like the probe. Yeah. Well, there's always a plane in which, if you've got two vectors, B and B, there is a plane defined by those two vectors, right?
They are in the same plane.
Well, they're in a plane, and it's the same one, right? So, I mean, any two vectors, no matter what two directions you choose, you can always say they're in the same plane because that's the plane third that they, just make a plane that goes through both of them. And then the force is perpendicular to that plane defined by those two vectors. And the only thing that they could do, I guess, is they could be parallel, in which case the force is zero. Or they could be anti-parallel, in which case the force is also zero. So yeah, they don't form a plane if they're parallel or anti-parallel. But if they're not anti-parallel or parallel, then they form a plane, the force is always perpendicular to that plane. And then, so there's that's the angle that comes up in there. But oftentimes that angle is 90 degrees. And that's what's going on here. So so when you kind of work with particle motion in 2D, then you've got everything is always mutually perpendicular. And this magnetic force, since it's perpendicular to the velocity, it forms a perfect centripetal force. So remember when I'm twirling a ball on a string around in a circle, the string has tension which is perpendicular to the velocity, the tangential velocity, right? That's exactly what's going on with magnetism, is that you've always got that force perpendicular to the tangential velocity, so it's a perfect centrifugal force. So what's going on here, it says, assuming the particle is negatively charged, what is the direction of the magnetic field in chamber one? So this is where you have to use the right-hand rule and then do the opposite of what the right-hand rule says because it's a negative charge. So chamber one is over here. So let's just start right down here, I guess. The velocity is up. That's your V. It's asking you for the direction of the magnetic. So wait, actually, which way is the force? So at this point, its velocity is up. It's toward the center of the circle. So it's going to be at that point, it's going to be that way. Up here, it'll be down, right? It's going to continue. But you have to choose a point. So let's put the force right like that. So
What I'm going to do is use the right-hand rule and say which way would the magnetic field be if it was a positive charge, and then I'm going to flip. Make sense? So velocity is the thumb going up. Force is like your palms, whoop, like that. And so the magnetic field is out of the page. So if particle were plus, then B is out of the page. B is into the page. So I would write here into page. Make sense?
Why is velocity always perpendicular to force? And what if it is?
Yeah,
why?
Velocity is always perpendicular to the force. That's a property of magnetic field. So it's cross product, right? Remember, it's F is equal to QV cross B. So it's a property of cross bias. But it's a property of magnetic fields that they cannot accelerate. They can't speed up or slow down any charged particles. They can only turn. And that is because of this idea, forces is perpendicular to V and perpendicular to V. Sorry, to B and V. But it doesn't, V and B don't necessarily have to be perpendicular to each other, and so you can get these helixes, you can have things spiraling along the magnetic field lines. Yeah, well, the force is going to be, it's going to be a sine theta net, or a cosine theta. It'll be, QV, B, cos theta. That's right. Yeah.
So with the force, would it be like a net force with magnetic and
yeah. Yeah, so it's actually plus Q times E. That's the whole equation. Yeah, that's a really good point. So the idea is that magnetic force and electric force are just two different forces. Net force is the sum. Okay? And that does come up sometimes. It comes up in Hall effect where you have a magnetic field causing the particles to want to go one way, and then you have a voltage that gets set up with an electric field which actually cancels out the magnetic force, and then you get net force is zero and you get a steady current going along. Okay. And then the next question was, the particle travels a length of 2.7 meters through chamber 2. So it's showing this distance. S equals 2.7 meters, like arc length, I guess. If it has a mass of 3.2 grams, what is the magnitude of the charge of the particle? So now I'm not worried about all the right-hand rules. I'm just using that QV cross B thing, and we're going to assume everything's perpendicular. So basically, F is equal to Q times V times B. And this is assuming that V is perpendicular to B. Okay. Then the cos theta is 1. F equals QVB, that's kind of a nice equation to use if V is perpendicular to B, which it almost always is. And you set that equal to centripetal, MV squared over R. Make that one more clear, okay? Centripetal force is provided by the magnetic force. Okay, and so then I've just solved for Q. I think we're going to have to get R, for Q, which is what you're asked for. So basically, S is equal to the circumference divided by 4, I think, because that's a quarter circle, is the 2.7 meters. It's equal to 2 pi R divided by 4, I guess. So that means that R is equal to 2 times 2.7 meters divided by pi. Okay. So the squared here cancels this V. Get that Q is equal to M times V over B times R. So it's 3.2 times 10 to the minus 3 kilograms times 15 meters per second divided by 1.5 teslas. And then there's R. So I think there's a 2 and there's a 2.7 meters and there's a pi. Anyway, I got 0.0186. So Q is equal to, I guess, two significant figures because the Tesla, 0.019 coulombs. Okay. I spilled about that. Any questions? Okay. Yeah, so there we go. So that's the centripetal force being provided by the magnetic force.
Magnetic force is important for fast-moving electrons. Okay. It's a good centripetal force because force is perpendicular to the velocity. Okay.
Mass spectrometers use this fact. Okay, what a mass spectrometer is, if you've got a magnet, gives some constant magnetic field. You've got a beam of ions, which contains particles of various different masses. And then the radii, they all get charged up the same way. It's just not one electron off every single atom. So they all have plus E charge. And then, so the radius turns out to be proportional to the mass. So different isotopes go into different radii you can collect along. Really what you do is you dial that speed so that your detector gets different radius. You've got a spectrum where the peaks correspond to a whole bunch of particles of that particular isotope. Okay. And cyclotron. So this is this idea of spirals, is that the force is perpendicular to the velocity. So it's a centripetal force in this plane that's perpendicular to the magnetic field. And then there's a constant velocity that's parallel to the magnetic field. And you combine those two motions, you get a spiral. And that's what protects the Earth from charged particles from the sun and from just the galaxy and other galaxies. Okay, if we had no magnetic field, then these charged particles would just hit the Earth and there'd be much more radiation, background radiation. And it also makes these beautiful aurora. Have you ever seen that? Okay, let's get back to you. Steph, what's this one? Oh! Yeah, so we're on to relativity and time dilation.
Okay, so I have some clever questions about this. This is another one of these ones of what's going on here? Let's review. I can't make this my phone. Let's see. Okay. All of relativity is based on this very simple idea, which is that the speed of light is the speed of light. So basically, everybody measures the speed of light to be the speed of light. Now, you may all be sitting there thinking, well, that sounds pretty lame. Obviously, the speed of light is the speed of light. It's not the speed of my car, it's the speed of light. That is the speed of light. The speed of light is the speed of light. It sounds tautological. But think about this. You've got, Mort has got a flashlight. And so he looks at the photons coming out of his flashlight and says, hey, look at those photons. There they are traveling along at C, speed of light. And then you've got Velma, who's flying by at a quarter of the speed of light, and looks down at those photons that are coming out of Mort's flashlight, and says, hey, look at those photons. They're going the speed of light. Okay? And this is the problem, is that that clearly makes no sense at all, right? And in fact, you can even observe, these photons are moving at speed c relative to Mort and to Velma. This doesn't work with any of these relative velocity equations that we've been using. It just doesn't work. And if you do really believe this, what if she's moving, okay, at 0.9999999 times c? She still sees those photons to be going at c. According to Mort, Velma is only moving 0.000001c, or 300 meters per second slower than his light beam. And yet she still sees those photons traveling by her at speed c. So something gets screwed up here. And what gets screwed up is that her clocks are running slow, time is running slow, and her meter sticks are shorter. And those two combine to make it seem to her, and it can measure to her, to be these photons going at the speed of light. Because how do you measure speed? Well, you take a meter stick, and you measure the distance, and you divide by the time. So if your clock is running slow and your meter stick is really shrunk, you're going to get the wrong speed, right? Or you're going to get the right speed for yourself, but it's going to be different than somebody else measures. So, and this is true. Space and time are relative to the observer.
And we don't normally notice this because we don't travel at speeds close to the speed of light. So all these, this way we conceptualize the universe, that time is this, tick, tick, all of our clocks are ticking at the same rate, and the whole universe has got all clocks going everywhere, going tick, tick, tick. Okay, there's some time. We all know what time it is. Oh, well, we sync our watches. That's not possible in physics, really, because time is relative to your observer. So, and this is, gets, you know, another way of picturing it, this is how you derive the equation, if you think about a light clock. What is a light clock? Well, it's a clock with just two mirrors with a photon bouncing between it. Every time the photon bounces, it goes tick, 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 tick. So if it's sitting still relative to you, then it goes tick, tick, tick at some rate. If it's moving, then it ticks slower because these photons have to travel this diagonal. Okay. So, Fred and George are twins. This is a twin paradox. They're identical. They have identical lifespans. They each have their own little light clock, which they carry in their pocket. It goes tick, 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 tick. They know what time it is. All right. It ticks once every millisecond, okay? So they expect if they're both, you know, since they have identical DNA, they're going to both live to be exactly 80 years old. They're going to expect that they can count 2.5 trillion ticks on their clock, and then they die. Okay. So here's a clicker question for you. Fred is flying on his broomstick to the right at 20% the speed of light, whereas George stays at home. So Fred's light clock is going tick, 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 because those photons are traveling on a diagonal. How many ticks of Fred's clock does George observe for his life, I guess? Before Fred dies, I guess, or George dies, right? George is going to observe for 80 years. How many ticks will he see Fred on Fred's clock? More than 2.5 trillion or fewer than 2.5 trillion?
We can't?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Forgot to turn it on. So this is from George's perspective. 80 George years have gone by. And then George is just about to die. How many Fred ticks does he see? Stop. Survey says it's going to be fewer, right? Because that clock ticks less often. So now the next question is, George is dead. He's going, ugh, and he's, George is dying, okay? And I don't know if he has an ear or not, I can't remember. But the point is how's Fred's health, I guess? Is he also about to die? Or does Fred have more life to live? Or has Fred been dead for 20 years? Like, what happens, what's going on with Fred? Okay. So he says, Fred has more life to live. The fountain of youth is just going fast. He's going to live another 20 years. Why? The reason is because in Fred's pocket is his light clock. And it's ticked, it hasn't ticked very many times. And he doesn't know he's moving. And so he's still going to keep living. So basically your heart rate, your brain patterns, everything about you must also slow if your light clock's slowing down. So moving slows down time itself. Time slows. And here's the twin paradox. Now, what's going on here? Hold on. Fred flies the broomstick to the right at a speed of, I've had trouble arranging this PowerPoint. So down here is Fred traveling to the right, but in Fred's frame of reference, George is now traveling to the left.
add 20% the speed of light. And over Fred's life, he's going to die after 30 years. How many ticks of George's clock does Fred observe during his 80 Fred years?
All I'll say here is that, so let's look at, yeah, it's sort of split, isn't it? So the answer is, fewer, it's B. Idea being that in Fred's, from Fred's perspective, George is the one whose clock is ticking slower. This is irreconcilable, okay? In Fred's frame of reference, George is the one who lives longer, okay? But the point is, that they're so far away from each other that they can't really ever have funerals or be attend each other's funerals. Like, it's just not going to happen. So basically, for Fred, George lives longer. For George, Fred lives longer. Time is completely relative to your own observer. And then, so we're going back now to this test question. Okay, so there's the time dilation equation. It's delta t is equal to delta tau divided by this crazy square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, okay? And that thing is called gamma, and it's greater than 1. So, and the idea here is that time dilation stretches out for the moving observer. So the trick is always trying to figure out which one's your delta t and which one's your delta tau. And it's the rule is, it's a hard rule to apply, it's the first sentence. The time interval between two events, that's delta tau, is when the two events occur at the same place. So for example, let's say you're in a spaceship and you're going to travel from Earth to Saturn. So what you do is your spaceship has some stairs. You walk up the stairs. You get in your spaceship. And the doors close on Earth. And you see, like, Earth. And then you go to Saturn. And then the doors open. And you're on Saturn. And it's the same doors, the same stairs are there, and you can walk down the stairs. So the two events are door closes on Earth, doors open on Saturn. So in the spaceship frame of reference, those happen at the same place, because it's just by the stairs. So that's delta tau. And everybody else measures delta t, which is longer. So the moving person doesn't age as much. Yes?
For the previous question, isn't it not true because Fred's reference frame is not inertial?
Well, they're both inertial. But in this case, what happens is that there is a problem. A set of twins, Andrea and Courtney, are initially 10 years old. While Courtney remains on Earth, Andrea arrives in a spaceship which travels away from Earth at a speed 0.6 c for 5 years, as measured by Courtney, then immediately turns around and comes back at 0.6 c, and then you compare their ages upon the return. So in that case, the turning around makes Andrea's frame not inertial, because in order to turn, you have to decelerate, slow down, and then turn around. So, but you can make them inertial by just splitting up the motion into two segments. That's how you solve this problem. Okay, let's solve it. This will be the last one of the time. Okay, so they are not accelerating for, so this is Andrea. Sorry, Andrea is not accelerating for the first half of the trip, nor the second half. So we can do both of these using special relativity equations for the first half and then for the second half, and just add them. That's what I'm going to do. So first half, what's happening here is that so it's Andrea, the leaving Earth and getting out to space are in the same place. So leaving Earth and arriving wherever they're going, way out in space, are events at the same place for Andrea. Okay, so that means Andrea measures the delta tau. And so then that means that Courtney measures delta t, which equals delta tau, divided by square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay, so that's pretty much it. The Earth, so back in this Earth frame, it's delta, that's Courtney, right? That means that delta t is equal to 5 years. And then v over c is equal to 0.6. And so basically, sulfur delta tau is equal to 5 years times, I think, the square root of 1 minus 0.6 squared, which equals 4 years. So that means that on the first half of the trip, Andrea ages 4 years. And then she does some turning, which might happen pretty fast, and she's not inertial during the turning. And you can't use special relativity equations when someone's turning or slowing down or speeding up, because it has to be inertial reference frames. So then, second half, you get similar equations. Again, delta tau equals 4 years. Okay? So total is that delta tau is 4 plus 4, equals 8 years. So it's 18. Questions about that one?
Yep. Instead of splitting into 5 years and 5 years, can't you just use 10 years?
Yeah, you kind of can. But the problem is, I mean, it's not quite right. Because again, you said you have to have things in inertial reference frames. They can't be speeding up or slowing down. And that's because otherwise you've got the twin paradox, right? You could, which one's the delta tau and which one's the delta t, right? And if things are very separated apart, you can have failure of simultaneity and somebody older than some younger and older than each other at the same time. But it's when they re-meet up again and they shake hands and look at each other, you have to tell you which is older. And the answer is Courtney is older. That's the answer. Because, and it really is, because Andrea did a bunch of accelerating at the end. That's what probably caused it. Somehow that acceleration must have aged her. Because Courtney didn't experience any acceleration. She just sat on Earth. Right? You use the special relativity equation, that equation, you can use it if you assume inertial for the first half, inertial for the second half. It's a bit of a subtle point. Anyway, I think that is pretty much it for me today. I will see you guys. I will be there. I'll be wandering around the different rooms. There's 3 different rooms. I'm just going to keep going from room to room, so you can, you know, ask me a question or say hi or whatever. Also, you know, you've been my student since September, probably. I would say, you know, come on by. I'd always be happy to see you. Good luck with everything. And,